This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm Prabhu Tyagaraj. Today's Jodcast, we are interviewing Thomas Torres from University of Bonn and Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy, Germany. Welcome, Thomas Torres.
Thank you.
And I have with me Thomas Scragg from the University of Manchester as well. Thomas Torres, would you like to tell us what made you do the special visit to the University of Manchester today?
Well, I was invited to give a colloquium by René Brichon, who is a colleague of mine and I've known for quite a long time by now. And this was a very nice opportunity for me because despite being in the pulsar field for many years, working on neutron stars, I've never been to Manchester and visiting this institute.
What is your research interest and what are you working in the University of Bonn?
So my research interests are fairly broad. I'm interested in, mainly in compact objects, that is white dwarfs, neutron stars and black holes. So the end products of stars at the end of their life, they make a transition from a normal non-degenerate star into a so-called compact object. I also work on supernova explosions, and I work on binary evolution, that is mass transfer and other interactions between stars. I work on gravitational waves, and I do quite some Monte Carlo simulations and population synthesis as well, which is to mimic a synthetic population of binary stars in our galaxy.
So you said compact stars. How compact stars? I thought they will be big.
Well, compact stars are, as the name suggests, very compact. So at the end stage of the evolution of a normal star, there are three possibilities. So either a star can transform itself into a so-called white dwarf. So this happens if the star has an initial mass which is less than about 8 times the mass of our sun. Then it becomes a very compact object which has roughly the size of the Earth, which is several hundred times the size that it had at the end of its life when it's a giant star. It's very large, but then it sheds the outer envelope, and the remaining part becomes a very compact object called a white dwarf, which has a mass density of a few hundred kilograms per cubic centimeter in average. So it's about the size of the Earth, and yet the mass is some fraction, say 70% of the mass of the sun, so it's rather compact. Now, if the original star is more massive than, say, 8 times the mass of our sun, say between 8 and maybe 25 times the mass of our sun, then the end of the evolution of the star is much more violent. It happens that a supernova explosion will occur, and the remnant of the supernova explosion is a so-called neutron star, which is made principally of neutrons, and in these objects the central density is enormously large. We're talking about some 10 to the 15 grams per cubic centimeter, or some billion tons per cubic centimeter. So this is a very dense object. And the third possibility for the final stage of the star is that it can become a black hole if the initial mass of the star is even more massive than roughly 25 times the mass of our sun.
So is there a way to look at them using any telescope? And how will we know that these compact objects exist out there in the space?
This is a very good question. Because these objects are very compact, they're difficult to see because their luminosities are usually small. So usually the luminosity of a star or stellar object scales with the radius squared. But because these compact objects are so small, like a white dwarf being the size of the Earth, a neutron star only having a radius of about 10 kilometers, then the luminosities from these objects are fairly small, so they're not very easy to see. But many of these compact objects are found in a binary system with another star. And because these compact objects are so compact, they are often able to retrieve material from the companion star such that they can basically eat their companion star. And when this material falls down the deep gravitational well towards this compact object, then there will be emission of typically X-rays.
Wow.
And that means we can see these compact objects in so-called X-ray binaries.
Oh, so if they don't retrieve any material, we have no means to see them.
We can only see these compact objects if they're not in a binary, if they're very young. So when a white dwarf or neutron star is just being produced, it's usually rather hot. So therefore, the luminosity is also fairly large because the luminosity scales with the temperature to the power of 4, the surface temperature. So when these compact objects come right off out of the oven of their progenitor star, so to speak, they're very hot, but they cool off rapidly. But if you're lucky and you catch this compact object right after its formation, within the first, say, few million years after its formation, it will still be hot and you can see it even if it's not in a binary system. But the older it gets, the cooler it becomes, and therefore these older compact objects you can only see in binary systems. Unless you are looking at a so-called radio pulsar. So a radio pulsar is a specific subpopulation of neutron stars, which are fairly rapidly spinning, and they possess strong magnetic fields, and therefore these spinning neutron stars produce a beam of radio waves. And if this beam of radio emission is pointing towards the line of sight to the Earth, then we can see these radio pulses, and therefore we can also see isolated neutron stars if they are radio pulsars.
So you mentioned they are binary objects, which means two objects going one around the other?
That's right.
So under what circumstances these kind of objects go around each other?
Well, this is actually an interesting question, and this is actually the core of my research field. Or my research interest is indeed to understand how you can make two such, in some cases you have two compact objects in a binary system orbiting one another. So how on Earth is it possible that two neutron stars, for example, end up in a very tight system orbiting one another? The thing is, to produce a pair of binary neutron stars, you have to start off from the beginning with two fairly massive stars, and these stars have to interact with one another in order to end up in a very tight combination. So you have mass transfer going on back and forth, and you have two supernova explosions producing the two neutron stars. So there are many obstacles along the way in the evolutionary path from the CRH main sequence when these massive stars are being born until they finally settle as two neutron stars. So this is indeed a very fascinating cosmic journey that these binary stars are taking. But we have to keep in mind that if you look into the night sky and look at these very massive stars that do produce neutron stars, then almost all of these massive stars are actually a member of a binary system. So binarity is a natural phenomena.
That's very, very interesting. So I'm tempted to ask this question. Is 2 is a stable number, or it can go to 3, 4? Do we have objects with more than 2?
We do actually know of triple systems and quadruple systems and even higher multiple systems. But when the number of stars in the system becomes larger than or equal to 3, then many of these systems will not be stable in the long term because there are some more or less chaotic interactions. This is the well-known three-body interaction problem. And it's difficult to keep these systems bound. But it can often happen, for instance, that you can have a quadruple system which is made up of 2 binary systems, each containing 2 stars. So you have 2 binary systems which are then orbiting their common center of mass, making a total of 4 stars. And this can also be a stable configuration, of course.
So usually when we say they are binary or are triple systems, do they have to be at certain distance, or they could be the radius could be quite far?
Well, binary stars can, in principle, have any orbital separation. The 2 stars can be as close to one another that they basically touch and you have mass transfer between the 2 stars. The separation can also be so wide that they don't have any interaction whatsoever besides from gravity, so the orbital period may be thousands of years. Whereas if we talk about triple systems, then they order in a so-called hierarchical pattern. So there are some limits to how you can make a configuration of 3 stars. So, for instance, you can imagine that you have a system with 3 stars where you have, for instance, a massive star more or less in the center of this system, and then you can have a binary system orbiting this massive star. But then there are some restrictions to the separation between the 2 stars in a binary system and then the orbital semi-major axis in the triple system, so to speak, so between the massive star and the binary. So there are some ratios which must be fulfilled in order not to have a system that becomes critically unstable in the long term.
I'm tempted to think another very interesting connection with our solar system. sun with several planets around. This is also a multi-body system.
Right.
Seems to be running stable for a long, long time.
Yes.
So how a triple system can become unstable and multi-body systems like solar system exists?
Well, it depends on the hierarchical structure. It's a little outside of my research field, but I think the way one can understand this is that in the solar system, you have one central star, and then you have all the planets orbiting the sun. So in our case, we have 8 planets orbiting the sun. They're all orbiting around the center of the mass of the solar systems, which is coincident with the location more or less of the sun, because the planets are not very massive compared to the sun. But in a system with 3 stars, for instance, you can also have the situation, you have, say, a massive central star, and then you have 2 less massive stars orbiting the central star, more or less like 2 planets would do. But you can also have a configuration where you have that the 2 stars are orbiting each other, while at the same time, the center of mass of that binary is orbiting a central star. And in such configurations, the ratio between the separation between the 2 stars in a binary and the distance to the central star becomes quite important for stability.
Thomas, you have a question, yeah, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, it just sounds like a similar situation with the Earth and the Moon, orbiting a common center of gravity, and then that center of gravity is orbiting the Sun. That's kind of illustration of the way that system would work?
Yes, you can say that. So you can imagine if you have the distance between the Earth and the Moon, if that distance would grow and become very large, extremely large, then at some point the orbit of the Moon around the Earth would also be unstable with respect to the Earth motion around the Sun. Now, this is nowhere near to be the case now, but for a triple system, it's roughly the scale has to be such that the distance from the central star to the binary has to roughly to be 3 times larger than the internal separation between the 2 stars in a binary. And of course, if we talk about the Earth and the Moon system compared to the Sun, we're nowhere near this factor of 3, because as you probably know, the distance from the Sun to the Earth is about 150 million kilometers. Whereas the distance between the Earth and the Moon is only some 400,000 kilometers. So this is a factor of more than 300. So we're nowhere near this critical limit of a factor of 3.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. Do we have these several of these binary and objects that we have detected? And what's the significance of finding them? Is it very much required in your current research?
Well, I'm a theoretician, so I'm studying how 2 stars in a binary system interact with one another and perform mass transfer and what comes out of this. So, of course, the work I do is very much dependent on what the observers find, because you always have to compare your theoretical work to observations. Otherwise, there's no way to calibrate what you're doing. And then in the end, we don't really learn anything if we don't have the observations. So it's very important that we have observations of binary systems. And luckily, we have many spaceborne X-ray detectors, which can detect these compact objects in binaries for which we see this X-ray emission. But we're also lucky that we have some of these radio pulsars, which we can observe with radio telescopes, such as the Lovell telescope right outside of Manchester. And in some cases, you have situations where a pulsar is orbiting another star. And this information is very useful for the work I do when I try to model the formation and the evolution of these binary systems.
So these objects which they go around one another is always in a rapid motion. Will it disturb the detection that we do, or when we are looking at them, the signals, do they get distorted because of this?
Yes, there are some selection effects that sometimes makes it difficult to observe a binary pulsar, for instance. If the orbital period is very small, say less than a few hours or so, then you have quite some acceleration of the radio pulsar around the common center of mass in the binary system. And therefore, there can be some smearing of the emitted radio pulse signal that the observers have to account for. So it can sometimes be difficult to pick out these very rapidly accelerating pulsars in very tight binaries. But of course, we hope that our observational colleagues will succeed, because the more extreme, the more tight these binaries are, the more interesting they also are from a theory point of view.
So moving on from the astronomy, you have interest towards reaching the public with science information.
That's right.
So would you like to tell us what special programs that you have been doing in terms of outreach?
Well, at some point I wrote a book, popular science book about astronomy. It's in Danish. It's 232 pages.
Wow.
And it's actually a book without any illustrations or any pictures whatsoever. So you might think that nobody would want to read a book about astronomy without any illustrations or any pictures. But there were some very special circumstances from the publishing company. They were making a whole series of books which are dedicated to different topics. What is sociology? What is astrophysics? And all of these titles. So there's a whole branch of different titles. My job was to write this book about what is astrophysics or what is astronomy. And when I learned from the publisher that the book would be without any pictures or illustrations, I said, no, thank you, because nobody wants to buy such a book and nobody's interested in reading it. But then I thought about it for 2 weeks and I came back to the publisher and I changed my mind. I would like to write the book because I realized that for me personally, it would be such a big challenge to see if I could write a book, and only with the help of the written word, if I could excite and stimulate interest in the cosmos only with the help of words, then this would be a very interesting challenge to try to achieve. I mean, if you compare to all other astronomy books, you always see beautiful colored pictures. And I should say, this is how I think such a book should be like. But it's easy to show a beautiful picture of a galaxy and then basically write figure captions underneath and then continue that page after page. But in this book I wrote, I described astronomy from old Babylonian and Greek astronomy all the way up to modern Big Bang theory, only with the help of words and no illustrations. And this was a big challenge to me. Wow. It took me 2 years, but I succeeded. And luckily, the reviews in various newspapers were very positive.
Wow.
So that was nice. And since then, I have written some newspaper articles for Danish media, mainly.
Are you planning of bringing the Danish book to the rest of the world in a different translation?
I think the market for a book without any pictures is still very limited. So I don't think I would succeed in finding a publisher who would publish this book. But I would like to actually publish the book with the same content, but just including colorful pictures. So that would be something that I would like to do sometime when I find the time to do this.
And you have also been traveling around the world in connection with your research.
That's right. Quite a few times. I did my PhD work in Australia, so I was there quite a bit. And then, of course, I always took every opportunity to travel between Denmark and Australia in a different way. So either going through some small Pacific islands or going through Borneo or whatever on the way back. So I got to see quite a bit of the world at that time when I was a PhD student.
Wonderful. And coming to the talk that you will be giving to University of Manchester Jodrell Bank Group of Astrophysics today, since the listeners in the podcast will be missing your talk, do you want to give what you will be telling in a nutshell for them today?
Sure. My lecture today will be on the formation of double neutron star systems. So this is how nature manages to produce a binary system of two neutron stars orbiting each other in a close orbit. So I'm going to discuss, for the major part of this talk, I'll discuss the formation of such a system, starting from the beginning where two massive stars are being born, and then going through all the mass exchange interaction stages and the two supernova explosions until one forms such a system with two neutron stars. And then the last part of my talk will be more dedicated to the expert working on neutron stars, where I will discuss our recent research on the formation of such double neutron star systems. So this might be a little more technical, but this is the plan for the talk today.
Thank you. Tommy, do you have anything?
Yes, a couple of things, really. Most people's view of astronomers or astronomy is maybe sitting at an observatory, looking up at the sky and observing things. But as a professional astronomer these days, most of the time he's spent in an office working behind a computer screen. How do you find that? Is some of the romance missing? Or?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think it's sometimes we often forget, so here I'm talking about professional astronomers, sometimes I think we often forget the beautiful universe and the whole beauty of the whole cosmos as such. Because even our observational colleagues, they don't sit anymore at the telescope side and stare into the sky. Quite often they just receive the data from a given telescope that somebody else has taken for them, and they just view the data on a computer screen without actually being at the telescope. And I often find it quite a pity that that professional astronomers don't have this link anymore to standing out in the open air and glare into the night sky. And I often see this enthusiasm if I go to visit amateur astronomers who will meet night after night, very cold and remote places. They will gather together and look into the night sky. And this is really a good thing. This is very beautiful. And I wish that more people would do this. And I wish that more professional astronomers like myself would find the time to actually spend more time outside and just glare into the cosmos and just enjoy it. Because it's really beautiful, and you don't have to be an expert to enjoy the look of the universe. It's fantastic for everybody.
I agree. I belong to an amateur astronomical society, and that's literally what we do. We just stand there, cold night, looking up at the clouds. It'd be Manchester, but occasionally it clears and we get a view of the sky. The plus side is you don't have to be at an observatory anymore. You don't have to travel to far-flung places. You can work literally from home.
That's right.
And get involved with, you know, modern astronomy. Well, I think that's one of the things we like to stimulate with the outreach side.
Right.
What drew you into neutron stars and pulsars in the first place?
When I was a master's student at the University of Aarhus in Denmark, so I'd done my bachelor in physics and I just started my master's studies, I was considering whether or not I should go into nuclear physics or astrophysics. But then I had a lecturer who made a big impact on me. He was lecturing on the physics of compact objects, following the classical book by Shapiro and Tucholsky on the physics of white dwarfs, neutron stars, and black holes. And I was immediately sold. I just got hooked on neutron stars immediately, and I found that these objects were so exotic and so fascinating, the most perfect physics laboratories that you could think of. And since then, I have just totally been involved with neutron stars, and they are indeed very fascinating objects, and they will always be fascinating objects. So there are still so many things to investigate about these objects.
One last question, coming back to somewhere in the, when we were talking, you mentioned about population synthesis and modeling. So what is this about? Is it about stars or?
Population synthesis and the modeling of a synthetic population can be applied to many different areas of science. So what we do in astronomy is that sometimes to answer questions about where a certain population of stars come from and what they evolve into, we try to make a synthetic population of say billions of stars. So we have some distributions of their masses and their orbital periods and so forth. And then we try to simulate the evolution of a large number of stars. So, for instance, for learning more about the rate at which double neutron stars form, the rate at which these neutron stars can later collide and produce gravitational wave events that will soon be detected, we make a synthetic population of billions of these binary stars, and then we evolve them right from the beginning. We evolve these stars and follow them, follow the mass transfer, follow the explosions, and see what the outcome is. And then we try to vary some of the input physics parameters, because there are many uncertain parameters in this business. And then by varying some of these parameters, we can study the outcome of the whole population. And then we can learn about the input physics by comparing the outcome to observations. So population synthesis simply means to mimic a large population of real binary stars, for instance.
Thank you, Professor Thomas Torres. It's been very nice speaking to you today for Jodcast. And on behalf of Jodcast, myself, Prabhu Tyagaraj, and Thomas Gregg, wish you the very best for your research work and for your journey into science.
Thank you very much. All my pleasure.